You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. Stella Perrette was a political cartoonist for the UK's only socialist daily newspaper, The Morning Star, from 2015 to 2020. She's published cartoons criticizing capitalism, the police, Brexit, the American president, and much, much more. It wasn't until she drew a cartoon called Endgame that she ran into trouble. It was commenting on the potential changes to the Gender Recognition Act in the UK and the political erosion of women's rights that led the Morning Star to censor her, pulling the cartoon after complaints from trans activists online. I spoke with her on May 11th about her career, her views on censorship, the value of satire, the dangers of gender identity, the Charlie Hebdo massacre, why feminists and the left need to stand up for free speech and free expression, and more. Here's that interview.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, great, Megan. Nice to talk to you again.
You too. Thanks for the time. And why don't we start by talking about you. You know, our listeners won't know much about you, or perhaps anything. What's your background in art? How did you get into doing all this?
Okay, well, at the moment, speaking to you up to now, I've been completely unknown amateur artist in Britain, and it's only until this thing happened to me, nobody would have even heard of me or seen much of my artwork at all, really. It was only from my association with this one newspaper, The Morning Star in Britain, which is what we're going to talk about a little bit in this podcast. So I've been an artist all my life. I'm 60. I've been an artist all my life, working for all kinds of people, writers, poets, individual people who are self-publishing on the internet, that sort of thing. And doing my one-woman shows in my hometown, Bristol, which I try to do an annual one, somewhere cheap and where people can easily get to, like a pub or something. And I've been doing that for years. I've given talks to people about cartooning and at the local university and people to do in my work as well. So that's what I do. I just get on with it, you know. And nobody would have heard of me. Except I managed to step a toe into this cesspit, which is when you dare to make a comment on this ideology.
So before we talk specifically about the cartoon you did for the Morning Star that was censored, what kind of artwork have you been doing? Has it been political artwork primarily?
Well, no, I mean, for years and years and years, I've been doing things like children's book illustrations, some science fiction, fantasy, that sort of artwork. And there's a lot of it on my website, which people are welcome to have a look at. I've documented a lot on there that I've done over the years. So I sort of started really doing the political cartoons 5 years ago when I became a regular cartoonist for the Morning Star. Which I was very pleased, really pleased about, because nobody appreciates my sense of humour. They were the first people who sort of got my jokes. Do you understand what I mean?
What's your sense of humour?
I suppose it's very dry. I mean, I'm British. I was brought up with comics like The Beano and The Dandy, which I don't know if Canadians will have heard about. So very, very old-fashioned humour, you know? Not malicious humour. Quite gentle, quite dry most of the time, you know. I don't do abuse in my cartoons. I don't, if I do caricatures of anyone famous, it's not to abuse them. It's to make some sort of point about something they've done or said. And that's my philosophy, you know. I don't believe in using the artwork to have a go at people. There's plenty of other cartoonists out there doing that, so I don't believe in doing that. I leave that to other people, you know.
And what's your political background? Do you have a political background?
Yeah, very much so. Where do I start? My goodness. I've been involved in local politics in Bristol for 20 or 30 years, running community groups, standing as a candidate for my local council, been in trade union work. I have to call myself a feminist. I was campaigning for gay rights and things when I was in my 20s, back in the 70s. Got involved in all that sort of thing, you know. I go back a very long way with the left. So it's been a bit of a shock to me. It's been a bit of a shock to me that this happened, really, with one cartoon, that I should become part of this, what we call council culture today.
Mm-hmm. So how long have you been doing cartoons for the Morning Star?
Since 2015, so five years. Mm-hmm. Until March, you know, February, March this year.
And the Morning Star is a leftist paper, is that correct?
It's not just a left-wing paper, it is the mouthpiece of the British Communist Party. So it is actually follows their agenda. I'll give you just an example. It's very, very ideological driven. When we had the Euro elections last year, we were voting about Europe, and the British Communist Party advised everybody to boycott voting in those elections. Now, boycotting elections, that might appeal, I was saying to my friends, that might appeal to the men in their audience, but it doesn't appeal to the women because of how hard women had to fight for votes, you know, any votes. Advocating boycott on elections. But that's the kind of thing, it's a very, very hard left ideology. They can't criticise any left-wing regimes like China or North Korea or Cuba or anything like that, you know. So their journalists are quite restricted in that way. And then obviously there's this ideology, which is another thing they can't talk about. And they printed this cartoon, which they printed hundreds of my cartoons in the 5 years. And there are also hundreds that they didn't print, you know. I was probably sending them two or three a week on spec.
So what kinds of cartoons were you sending them? Were they controversial? Were they? I assume they were political, considering the angle of the paper.
Yeah. Yes, obviously following their, coming from their angle. If you were sending cartoons to the Daily Mail, you'd be following their angle, do you know what I mean? So definitely following Morning Star's agenda, so the cartoons would be like having a go at the monarchy, having a go at the police, talking about poverty, inequality, the gig economy, these kind of subjects. Yes. So it was all that kind of subject. They were printing cartoons that I'm absolutely sure nobody else would print anywhere else. And I was always very impressed. I was always very impressed by the ones that I sent into them, which, you know, they were really, really quite edgy. And I thought, well, nobody else would print this except the Morning Star, you know. I did one quite recently about the royal family with the Harry and his girlfriend flying off to Canada and America, you know, absconding from the royal family. And it was called Parasites. So they were all hanging on to this enormous pink bottom. A load of parasites, you know, ticks and parasites sucking blood on this. Well, quite honestly, not many newspapers would print a cartoon like that. But the Morning Star did, you know.
Yeah. So tell me about what happened. So you sent in a cartoon that ended up being censored. So what was the cartoon? Can you describe it?
Yeah, it's a cartoon called Endgame. And it's still on my website. People can go and have a look at it. And even you've only got to Google Morning Star cartoon, actually, and you'll see it. It went quite widely around the Twitter sphere, you know. So it wasn't. It was one of two cartoons I sent in that particular week because it was big in the news. And the reason it was big in the news was because our second biggest political party, the Labour Party, here was having a big controversy going on that the candidates for their leadership had signed a pledge that if any of their members of their party mispronounced people, they could be expelled from the party. So this was big news. And so I sent two cartoons in. One was about the pronouns, and one was this cartoon called Endgame. And it was about women's safe spaces. Specifically, it was about women's only swimming sessions, which do go on at some sports centres here. You might have things like that in Canada, I don't know. And yeah, so it was a very literal drawing of what some women and girls and parents are afraid of if the Gender Recognition Act, becomes even more sort of entrenched, And it's done as a cartoon with cute little animal characters, and I think that's what upset a lot of people, the fact that it was sort of cute little characters. There were these little newts and an alligator. And I mean, it sounds laughable. I mean, it is laughable,
Well, it's supposed to
the
be
cartoon
funny,
was
but
not the cartoon was not meant to be not sent in as an offensive cartoon. I sent it in with an explanation as why I was sending it in. That I felt that it really is the end game for feminism. If feminism loses this battle, well, that's the end of it,
Yes,
So
absolutely.
they had an explanation of what I felt about the cartoon, and they printed the cartoon.
Great.
End of, And I heard no more about it for I suppose a couple of weeks because I don't even buy the paper myself all the time. And well, you can you in fact, it's such a niche paper that you often can't even find it in the newsagents anywhere. It's such a tiny circulation paper. And somebody came up to me at work, one of my union colleagues, and said, "Oh, your cartoon's made a bit of a fuss, because I didn't even know what he was talking about, And then I started finding out that they'd apologized for it, for printing it.
So what
So
happened?
they,
Did people
yeah.
start complaining online, or was it people
They, yeah,
within
they
the
were, yeah,
Morningstar?
absolutely. No, they were literally attacked, by a sort of Twitter mob saying that, oh, a left-wing paper shouldn't print this. This is transphobic. This is that, It was all directed at the paper. And what was really upsetting about it at the time is that the paper didn't tell me anything about this going on at all. Didn't tell their readers my explanation for the cartoon so that it was easy for people to take it out of context, and didn't keep in touch with me, didn't give me a right of reply, and basically have cancelled me as one of their cartoonists. So I've joined this club of women all over the world that this sort of thing is happening to,
Right. And when you sent in that cartoon, were you aware that, there was silencing going on around this issue? Did you think, this might happen to me? Had you seen what had happened to other women who had sort of talked critically about the issue of gender identity, ideology, and legislation?
Not when I sent the cartoon in. I was, to me it was a legitimate comment on an issue that was big in the news at the moment, because that's how I operate as a political cartoonist. You scour all the news. You look at the newspapers. You look at the websites. You what's on the radio. What's on the TV, and you see what's current, And so I would send them two or three cartoons a week on different subjects, and. Yes, obviously, I thought as I was doing with it, oh, there's quite a lot of emotion in this cartoon, but that's what cartoons are for. They're actually that's the reason newspapers have political cartoonists is to make a point in a way that will be remembered. So I don't I still maintain that it was not offensive, was not meant to be offensive. I wish the newspaper had given me right of reply. But since that time, a lot of I have been in touch with plenty of journalists involved in free speech who have supported me. So from that point of view, it hasn't really harmed me or anything.
It's
which is I'm yeah, sorry, go on, go on.
No, well, it's interesting to me that the left has taken up censorship with such enthusiasm. This has happened to me in terms of my writing. So I, back in around 2015, was working for a leftist online magazine here in Canada called Rabble.ca, and I had been cross-posting all of my articles there and my podcasts for a long time. I was working part-time as an editor there. I had provided original content to them, and for years. And I wrote an article that was critical of the language that was starting to be used by, women's organizations, reproductive rights organizations, the liberal feminists in the US and Canada. Probably it was starting in the UK also, but in this case it was around Planned Parenthood, starting to use terms like menstruators and pregnant people,
That's
specifically and
right. And
explicitly leaving out the term woman. And it was, so many women were angry. I mean, it's so dehumanizing and offensive, right? And we all know that, women are the ones who menstruate and women are the ones who get pregnant, and that
Well,
shouldn't be controversial to say at all.
yeah. I mean, since it's happened to me, I've been on a very steep learning curve. And I actually listened to a podcast you did with Posy Parker, who she lives in my town, actually.
Oh,
And I'm
cool.
obviously she actually she's a, obviously a hero at the moment of the feminist movement, like yourself. And I'm very hopeful maybe after the lockdown that I'll be able to get to meet her and have a drink with her, because she is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, she's
And so
great.
I
I bet she'd
literally
love
listened to a
to.
podcast that you did, back in 2015 with her. And that was about what her journey and what had happened with her, where she was involved in the left and groups within the Labour Party and so on,
So
So it is very, very odd because this is not, I don't really see this as an anti-trans issue that I've been involved with. It's a freedom of speech issue. Because obviously I'm a cartoonist, and that's my job. Although I wasn't even paid by the Morning Star, it's unpaid contributions to the Morning Star. It's supported by donations,
Yeah, so and what happened to me at Rabble with this article that I wrote that was critical of this language that was, erasing women and dehumanizing women, was they published it and, like 7 or 8 hours later pulled it again and didn't, and it's similar to what happened to you. They didn't contact me and say, "We're pulling this," and they didn't offer me an explanation. I had to email them about 3 times and say, and these are people that I work with on a daily basis. I wasn't even an outsider, and I had to email them like 3 times to say, "Hey, why was my article pulled?" And finally they told me it used transphobic language, and I was like, "Which language?" And I didn't understand what they meant, that, I wanted to know exactly what the transphobic language was, and to them, like, the response was all very vague. But in any case, my long point is that I am so angry and frustrated that the left doesn't support free speech and has become so uncritically invested in censorship. So I mean,
And yeah, and there's very little sense sisterhood, isn't there? I mean, I presume you had quite a good relationship with them up to that point.
I had for a long time, and I mean, things had started to get sort of difficult over. I mean, I had always been controversial because I had written about, I'm opposed to prostitution and pornography, and those kinds of things are controversial on the left. So there was always controversy, but they were supportive of me, of my right to write about those things, even if they didn't agree with me. But this, I guess, was just too much for them. I wonder, I mean, What other examples can you think of where something like this has happened? What I have been trying to do lately is to remind feminists and the left that this isn't just an issue around transgenderism and gender identity ideology. Obviously, women are being censored, particularly over this issue, but this is not the only issue. You know, there's
Oh, I'm
reasons that
so
we
glad you're
need
saying that, Megan.
like,
I'm so glad you're saying that because I completely agree with it. To me, this is an ism. It's one of many isms that people can get censored over and have been censored over through the years. And obviously, the others are pretty obviously racism, anti-Semitism, and anti-Islamism, and all those things are issues which cartoonists, artists have been. Had the same thing kind of happen that's happened to me and you. I have written a sort of list of them. If you're interested in me mentioning one or two of them,
Yeah,
in
definitely.
recent years. The first one I'm going to mention, the people that can, and you can look this up on Google. It's easy to find. This is a lady who she's not what a lot of people wouldn't think of her as a cartoonist. First of all, she was a painter, but her paintings are very like cartoons. They're very like the manga cartoons of Japan today. And she is known as the Big Eyes Painter. I don't know if that rings any bells with you. And her name is Margaret Keane. And Margaret Keane is 92 years old and still going strong. And she lives in Nashville, Tennessee. And it's her story is one of the most extraordinary stories of a woman having her artwork cancelled in the public arena and how she fought back against it. And people are welcome to, you know, obviously they can easily look this up on Google. But she's very much an inspiration to me. I mean, her own husband actually tried to pretend that all her artwork was his. You know, he put all his signature on all of her paintings and displayed them in his gallery as his artwork. And she was very much kind of under his thumb. It's what today we would call a coercive control. In her marriage, he was drunk, he was a bully, and all that, you know. And she eventually managed to escape from him with her daughter. And even after she had left, he was still pursuing her with lawyers and threatening her, and even death threats, you know, if she didn't carry on painting so that he could carry on selling them and making money. And she eventually had one of the most amazing court cases of the 20th century. Which is in the mid-60s, she sued him, and she also sued the newspapers who were supporting him. And the judge ordered her and her husband in the court case to sit down and paint one of her paintings, right? And of course, Margaret just sat there calmly painting, and he whinged that he had a sore wrist, and of course he didn't do it, and the judge found in her favour, and it's one of the most amazing court cases ever, you know. So she is still at her amazing age of 92, still running a gallery, and as far as I know, still painting. And so to me, she's an amazing example of a woman who had her artwork, you know, rubbished really, and tried to hide that it was her, you know. So that's fantastic, you know.
Yeah,
And in
and
recent
what
years, in recent years, there's been a few, mostly male cartoonists, I have to say, but there have been a few. The most recent one was January this year, which is a Danish newspaper called Jyllands-Posten, and I hope I've said that right. And they printed a cartoon about the China coronavirus. I don't know if you've heard about this, where they printed a cartoon of the Chinese flag. And instead of the stars was a little coronavirus symbol.
Yeah.
So it doesn't sound particularly harmful, does it? But anyway, nearly it caused an international incident with Beijing saying that all the journalists and artists they should be made to retract and apologise in public. And the newspapers stood up. They stood up for their editorial decision. They stood up for their artists. And the actual Prime Minister of Denmark, who's a woman, publicly said, "There's no reason for the newspaper to apologise, and Denmark has a proud history of satirical cartooning," which they do, you know. And that's an amazing thing as well, because you know that's the Prime Minister of the country saying no, you know, this newspaper shouldn't have to apologise.
I mean, thank
So,
goodness some people are still standing up.
for this stuff, because it's hard to.
It is hard to. And don't forget, artists have been, they've had death threats. Don't forget the Charlie Hebdo cartoonists were actually murdered. You know, these were old people, old defenseless people sitting in their own office, murdered.
I know, that's a really important example that we should talk about, the Charlie Hebdo case.
When that happened, the whole world was trending on Twitter, Je suis Charlie, to stand up with that newspaper and those artists. Je suis Charlie, I am Charlie. Everybody made badges out of it and put it out. And where's the solidarity today with artists and people that are being cancelled over this trans ideology, you know?
Well, yeah, but I mean, I do want to say that when that happened and everyone was saying Je suis Charlie, I saw on my social media timelines a whole bunch of feminists and leftists criticizing this and accusing Charlie Hebdo of being racist and Islamophobic, to the point that to me it seemed as though they were almost saying that they deserved it. You know, that this horrible thing that happened was deserved because this was a racist institution and these cartoonists were Islamophobic. And, you know, I didn't understand all the politics surrounding this at the time. I have to admit, you know, I wasn't familiar with Charlie Hebdo. And looking back, I'm just horrified.
Well, that may be on the Twitter, Megan, but in France, there was a rally, 2 million people crammed into Paris, 40 world leaders went to have a memorial, you know, rally in Paris in memorial for those dead cartoonists and dead journalists. And so there might have been a few people bitching about it on Twitter, but, you know, in the real world, there was a tremendous amount of support and sympathy. And, you know, I'm sorry, but the Twitter bubble, people have to get to grips with this idea that it's not real. You know, it's not in the real world.
Yeah, I completely agree.
They're not in the real world. The problem is that the ideology is leaked out into the real world and is causing real problems for people in many, many spheres of life, you know?
Yeah, I mean, my point in bringing that up, I think that you're exactly right. And I think that people who spend too much time on social media, whether it's Facebook or Twitter, in their political bubbles, start to think that their little bubble is the real world, and in fact it's not. And, you know, people out in the real world generally hold very different opinions than they do. And my point in bringing it up is only to say that a lot of leftists and feminists in my circles, I am out in the real world, so I know that, most people in the real world don't agree with these opinions. But nonetheless, I did find it troubling that people would express such things, you know, leftists that I knew and feminists that I knew. These are Canadians also. And, I should say that there's things, you know, in Canada, there isn't large support for free speech like there is in the US and in the UK. Canadians I don't think Canadians have learned, especially not Canadians on the left, they haven't learned that free speech matters. I think probably because they live such safe lives that they haven't
thought
could come back to hurt me. So it wasn't all of them at all. Around the world, obviously people were supporting Charlie Hebdo and pushing back against this tragedy. But why don't you are there any other important examples you wanted to bring up in terms of censorship of cartoons and cartoonists?
I'll be as quick as I can, and I apologize that they are mostly men, but you know, in the world of political cartoons, unfortunately it is mostly men. There are historical reasons for this. In Britain, in The Guardian, we've had two cartoonists in recent years, Steve Bell and Martin Rowson. Both of those had cartoons pulled and censored by the paper. The Sunday Times, their regular cartoonist, Gerald Scarfe, who's a very world-famous cartoonist, the same thing happened to him. Now, what those mostly were about was alleged anti-Semitism. And then the New York Times last year, you might know about this, is more closer to home for you, apologized for another alleged anti-Semitism cartoon, and not only apologized for it and sacked their own cartoonist who hadn't even drawn it, but said they were never, ever going to publish political cartoons ever again. So, you know, it's leaked out into the real world. For some reason, the very institutions, the very things like newspapers, like which are supposed to be, you know, the fourth estate, are supposed to be standing up for our freedom and freedom of expression, are the very people that are rolling over and dying for it. And it's very, very odd, isn't it? Because without freedom of speech, none of the games that we all have come to just think are normal, like, you know, our employment rights, you know, all the things that women fought for, all the things that men fought for as well, for the last 50, 60 years, you know, mm-hmm. gay rights, everything, none of these things would have happened without free speech. You know, it is the left who has actually benefited from free speech more than anybody else.
Exactly.
And free speech is one of these things that you lose it or use it or lose it, I'm afraid. Look what happened in Nazi Germany.
I know. I agree. And I'm just appalled at the way that, you know, at anybody who doesn't value free speech, or anybody who thinks that, you know, you can support free speech for some people or on some issues, but not on others. I mean, that's just not how free speech works.
And you and me both agree, and I'm sure everybody else agrees, that free speech doesn't mean that you can go around crucifying people. And yet the people who have done this to me and to many other women who have been making perfectly legitimate comment in the public arena, they have been practically crucified.
Yeah.
So by people on the left. And it doesn't make any real sense, does it, you know?
Yeah, I know. I mean, what happens is that you're libeled across the internet so much so that people start repeating facts as though it's true. So, you know, people will simply say, oh, you know, so-and-so is transphobic, so-and-so is racist, and then the rest of the left, or, you know, feminists or whomever it is, kind of just goes along with it. You know, it's like a game of broken telephone.
Yeah, but you see, I also say to people, and I've been saying this on Spinster as well, by the way, recently, and people seem to, you know, appreciate what I've been saying on Spinster, do not ever make the mistake of thinking that somebody who's left-wing is liberal or radical. Because real people from the real hard left are more likely to follow a communist ideology, you see, which is authoritarian and where people do as they're told and, mm-hmm. you know, you don't step out of line. So, you know, people who are from the hard left are more like that, you see. They're bound to be like that. That's the nature of the far left. So you can never equate left wing with being necessarily liberal or radical.
Yeah, it's true. That's a good point. You had mentioned to me, you know, before this conversation, a specific cartoon depicting Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu as maybe you can talk about that case.
I think that's the New York Times one that I told you about, which was only last year.
Yeah. So it was is him as a guide dog.
This is so fascinating because, I haven't even seen the cartoon, but I've heard it described often enough. So it apparently shows Netanyahu as a guide dog leading President Trump, who is blindfolded, on a lead. And this is about, the whole business of moving the American embassy to Jerusalem and all that sort of stuff, you know. And this was found so offensive that the New York Times was attacked for it. And the reason given for it being offensive was that the Nazis had called Jews animals, like dogs and cockroaches and things. And yet the image of one politician leading another on a lead, we would call it one of them being the other one's poodle in Britain, has been used so often throughout the years. Almost every cartoonist who's ever drawn a picture of politicians has probably used that theme at one point or another, right? And it's such a common theme for a cartoonist to use. And I'm absolutely sure that the cartoonist who did it never thought for one minute that it was offensive, but was just using a very common theme. You know, and yet that was so bad, that was considered so bad that the New York Times had to apologize, sack its cartoonists, never print political cartoons ever again, you know?
So have they actually done that? They've really committed to
Yeah, they have actually done that. Yeah, they've actually done that, yeah. Never print political cartoons ever again. It's just phenomenal, isn't it?
And what do you think
I can't believe it.
What do you think the dangers of that are, you know, not printing political cartoons? You know, why is it important that they do?
Yeah, well, the dangers of clamping down on anything satirical in this way is that eventually, you know, all journalism would just be the mouthpiece of the state, wouldn't it? I'm just going back way back in history now. Throughout from the 1600s all the way through to the mid-1800s, in Britain, there was no freedom of speech in the press. There was no such thing as journalists being able to report or say anything about, you know, go and report on Parliament, that kind of thing. It was all very restricted. And so they had to print things like court, which are called court circulars. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. That was what they had instead of being able to go along and do their own journalism. And so that was the very period where we had what's called the Golden Age of satirical cartoons in Britain. You see, people like Hogarth and Gilray and all those amazing cartoonists, and they spent their whole time really abusing the monarchy, abusing the rulers, you know, in far more, you know, far more abuse than people get today, but in cartoon form, because it was only the cartoons that they could print. They weren't allowed to go along and actually do journalism, you see. So that's called the Golden Age of British satirical cartooning, was in the very days when journalism was suppressed.
Right.
You see?
I wanted to talk about another example, and I think it was cartoonist Steve Bell, who in March... Yeah. Was it Steve Bell that did that cartoon with Boris Johnson and Priti Patel? I don't know how to pronounce her first name.
Oh, gosh. Now, actually, I don't know the one you're talking about. The one I know about Steve Bell is another Netanyahu cartoon. Netanyahu seems to be a real trigger point for people, you know.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, we don't have to get into that one. I mean, it's another example of, you know, he's criticizing power and bullying. So he depicted the two of them
as
bulls.
Yes, I do remember it. Yes. Yeah, she was on the yes, that's right. I do remember the cartoon.
So they both of them had, you know, bull horns and were sort of depicted in an animalistic way. And yet widespread response was that this was racism.
Well, again, it's a common theme to say that a politician is a bull in the china shop, isn't it? It's a very common comical theme, and so he did that because he's probably like me, he's probably grown up with British comics, you know. It's and then oh, that's racist. But he had Boris Johnson there with Bull's Ring as well, didn't he? Mm-hmm. So it's racist for Boris Johnson as well, is it? It doesn't make sense, does it? None of this makes sense. Mm-hmm. And this is just a series of isms that people aren't allowed to discuss or comment on or make jokes about in the public sphere. I mean, we have really gone down a rabbit hole with this. You know,
right.
we're getting to the point where our politicians are doing it, teachers, social workers, everybody has gone down this rabbit hole. And I am very pleased that this happened to me with the Morning Star, because it's been an epiphany for me. It's brought me back to the feminism that I was involved in my 20s, you know.
Totally.
So I'm very grateful. I'm very glad it's happened in a way, because I now find I've got friends I didn't know I had, you know.
It's a real learning experience when these things happen,
it
and
is.
It actually is a
oh,
really
gosh.
Important reminder, because I, you know, up until that point, you know, back in 2015, 2016, when I started to take this issue on of gender identity, I really hadn't had much to say about free speech. You know, I wasn't opposed to free speech. I hadn't spoken out against free speech per se. But it certainly wasn't something that I had stood up before. And I regret that. And I feel ashamed that I hadn't. But, you know, through, and, you know, the unfortunate truth is that often when we go through these experiences, we're reminded that this is about more. Or we should be reminded in any case that, you know, free speech is really important, but also that this is about more than just us. And we see that there's a slippery slope. So, you know, this can happen on any issue. This is just about ideology and politics and people who are ideologues wanting to shut down criticisms of their faith, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to realize that most women are involved in bringing up families and also having to work. And especially if they're like in the gig economy, they might be holding down more than one job and all this kind of thing. They might not have even time in their lives to even pay much attention to the news. Now, certainly in my case, by the time I hit my 30s, the whole thing of working sort of 6-7 days a week had took over trying to keep a roof over my head. And, you know, all the ideology and the campaigning, I was able to keep my artwork up, but any political activism I'd been involved with was basically, that was all shunted to one side, you know? And it's only, you know, as I've got older and that and this has happened to me now, that I feel, well, actually, no, it's time I went back and revisited all this. And lo and behold, I find that all the issues we were fighting for and worried about back then, nothing's blooming changed, you know? Nothing has changed.
And we find ourselves fighting for the very basics, you know, the basics of, yeah, of women having, yeah, rights, sex-based,
oh,
rights particularly.
I mean, in Britain we're waiting for this court case to do with the Tavistock Clinic, which, again, Posy Parker has done a very good podcast episode with somebody who's involved in that court case, which you might have come across, you might have heard, with Susan Evans, who's involved in that court case.
I haven't listened yet, but I will.
Yeah, very, very. I mean, I sat in here in my flat, and I played it with my husband, who isn't very clued up on these issues, and he was absolutely gobsmacked by it. You know, we're coming up to our 60s. You know, we grew up in a world where, you know, there wasn't this condemnation if you dared to discuss something.
Right.
It was a very different world, you know, and people were more civilized. I mean, when I was involved in local politics throughout my 30s and 40s, it was perfectly possible to have a massive disagreement with somebody from the opposite side of the fence, but you could still go to the pub with them and have a drink afterwards, you know?
Exactly.
You talk about the issue in the public arena or, you know, in the council chamber or wherever they were talking about it, but afterwards you could still be human beings. And today that doesn't seem to happen at all.
No, and I mean, this has been one of my frustrations also, because I am someone who is happy to disagree with people, and it really doesn't bother me, and certainly it doesn't mean I can't be friends with them, I can't be friendly with them, I can't have a civil conversation with them. It doesn't mean I hate somebody or I have to kick them out of my life because we have a disagreement. And in fact, I find disagreements very useful in terms of developing my own analysis. You know, maybe I'll hear their perspective and change my mind. You know, this is what thinking critically is.
Yeah, that's right. And what you said a bit earlier, where you said that you get a label put on you, like, now I'm somebody somewhere will probably think, oh, that's a transphobic cartoonist, which is absolutely ridiculous, because obviously your friends, your acquaintances, your whole circle know that you've never been that in your whole life, and you're never going to be, and that this label has been put on you for one thing, which has been took out of context. And, I don't want to be here on your podcast saying, oh, you know, oh, poor little me, because I just feel, well, no, I've actually joined a club which I'm quite proud to be part of with all these artists throughout history, really, who have been cancelled in this way have dared to make a comment on something that's in the public sphere.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to mention...
It's actually made me feel quite proud, actually. You know, I'm not going to sit there and apologise for it. You know, I already explained to the outlet concerned, the Morning Star, exactly what the cartoon was about. And if they didn't want to be bothered to tell their readership, you know, what my reasoning behind it was, well, that's their problem. It's made them look bad because they couldn't even stick up for their own editorial decision. And that's their problem, not mine, you know?
Right. I wanted to mention this example of something that happened in North America. I think that what happens nowadays with these kinds of reactions to these kinds of cartoons that are political or satirical is that people will look at them and they'll have a knee-jerk reaction, and they won't understand they won't understand the satire, they won't understand the symbolism, they won't understand the purpose of the cartoon, so they'll just leap to say, they'll leap to put these labels on it. This is transphobic, this is racist, this is Islamophobic, whatever. And here in North America, there was this guy, he's just an independent artist, he's living in LA, he's not some big, you know, he's not some wealthy guy, he doesn't own some company, he just kind of does his art for himself, and he, you know, sells his designs on t-shirts and things like that a bit. And he put out a design on his Instagram that he called Bat Fried Rice, and it was a design. It was never actually printed on a t-shirt, but he was saying, so it was an image of a takeout box with bat wings, and then it said, no, thank
you. Because of China, yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
And so, and you know, to be honest, I don't actually know what he was trying to say with that design, but so I'm not going to make assumptions about what he meant, but certainly he wasn't trying to be racist, and I've actually been in touch with him since then. And what happened was that... So the design caused a bit of a controversy, but only after this man living in Vancouver, which is where I live, posted a link to the design, I assume because they're friends. You know, he didn't even post about it, but he posted a link on his private Instagram account, and I guess someone saw it and caused a big stink and said and accused the art director working for Lululemon of being racist just for sharing the link. And then, of course, everyone was saying the design was racist. And I wrote an article, you know, criticizing the response. You know, there was this massive mob on Twitter, you know, it was covered in media all across North America, it was covered in the New York Times, so this guy who just shared a link was slandered across the internet as a racist, the artist was slandered as a racist, and then because I criticized the response and said, you know, this is clearly a joke, and, you know, why is it that, you know, we're not allowed to be critical of China, I don't know what he meant by it, but if he was, maybe it was a critique of Chinese power, maybe it was irony, maybe it was just a joke about the fact that this was all caused by one bat, but, you know, I criticized all this and said, you know, this is appalling, this man was fired from his job, I was accused as racist by feminists, in fact, and I was kicked out of feminist groups and slandered across the internet as a racist for criticizing this cancel culture.
All for a sweatshirt design. Yeah, it's just, that's just unreal. I mean, do you think a lot of that was because the guy himself was just like, didn't have big bucks behind him, didn't have a big company behind him? Like you say, he was an independent artist. Didn't have the money to employ a big lawyer to sue all these people for libel. I mean, do you think that was why it was worse?
I think, and I don't think that people think it through when they react, but I do think that the people who do react in this way target independence. So I'm an independent writer.
Yeah.
I work for myself. Yeah. I don't work for a company. I can't afford a lawyer. I can't I can hardly defend myself. You know, there's nothing I can do when people say these things about me or silence me. I mean, I can speak up about it, but I don't have institutional backing or anything like that. So these people, it's very easy for them to go after artists like that, people like you, people like me, and have success and feel a level of power because they did successfully shut us down.
It is, but I think there's a kickback going on. I mean, here in Britain, we've got a new thing called the Free Speech Union, and I think you interviewed Toby Young a week or two ago.
Yes.
Who set up Free Speech Union. Now, again, immediately it's, oh yeah, this is all right wing, all right wing, all right wing. Well, it's not, because if you have a look through all the people who are on its board and supporting it online, there is masses of people there from different communist background and different left-wing background, and academics from all over the world, and journalists from all over the world, and so it's not just a right-wing thing. People criticised him for setting it up. Why does he need to set it up? Well, this is why, because there are people who haven't got the money for the legal backup they might need. You know,
mm-hmm.
I haven't got the money, and they're going to help me out by doing a complaint on my behalf to the Morning Star. It doesn't mean anything will happen, but at least it means that somebody's got my back, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. What do you think has changed over the past few decades in terms of people's reaction and their opposition to free speech? It seems
well,
to me
easy,
that things
Megan,
are different.
Megan, that's easy. Everybody got the internet. That's a simple answer. Everybody got the internet, and that's it. When the internet came in, the joke was it's 90% pornography and 10% rubbish. That was, you know, the joke about the internet when it all came in. That is literally the reason. It has become so easy for people to just hide anonymously, you know, tap away on their keyboards in the middle of the night and ruin people's careers, ruin people's livelihoods, and ruin people's reputations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got a satirical magazine in Britain, the Private Eye, which has been going for 50 years. Its boast is that it's the most sued magazine in Britain. People are always suing it, and they have got so used to this that they've got lawyers who are so brilliant at dealing with these court cases that you know, nowadays hardly anybody ever wins when they sue the Private Eye. But the thing is, you have to be willing to stand up and say, no, this is satire. This is a joke. You know, we're having a go at our rulers. You know, we're having a go at authoritarian regimes abroad.
Yeah,
it's a joke. You know, a pair of bat wings have out on a you know, a Chinese takeaway box. It's not. It's a joke, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know. What's the difference? Did we grow up? We must have grown up in a more innocent age, is all I can say. We were brought up with cartoons and comics and things that just had a go at everything.
Exactly. I mean,
you know.
I'm so confused by the proud humorlessness of too many feminists and leftists. You know, they really can't take
a
joke.
It must be very hard work for them to get up every morning and be completely screwed up and angry and frustrated about every little thing that's going to happen during the day that's going to make them angry, you know? It must be a terrible life, you know? They must be sort of popping pills all day long to cope with it, you know?
I know, I think about that too. I'm like, what a miserable life to be so serious and so angry all the time. You can't laugh at anything.
I know. That is the whole point of satire. The thing about satirical art is that you can have a laugh about something that's quite deadly serious, you know? Because it's a release valve. It allows people to think about it from a different angle. Now, my cartoon might have made a lot of people stop. And by the way, I have had people contact me about that particular cartoon saying, yes, we did write. I wrote to the Morning Star in support. I could see that it was a comical way of describing an actual situation that people are actually worried about. You know, people have told me that they supported it. But, you know, it like you say, knee-jerk reaction, oh, comical little characters, bright colours. It probably takes people immediately right back to their childhood when they were looking at cartoons as a child. You know, they probably revert back to some sort of childhood state, you know. That's maybe why they have that reaction.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me about all this. I'm so glad that you got in touch with me. It's been, like, so refreshing to talk to someone about these issues and to talk to somebody with your history and who does your work. I think it's so important, and I think we all need to be reminded about why it is important and why it's important that we hang on to satire and political criticism and free speech, of course.
Well, can I before we finish, can I just have a shout out to all the people on Spinster?
Yes.
Which is an absolutely wonderful platform. Were you involved in setting that up, weren't you, I think?
No, I wasn't involved, but I did. No. Oh. I interviewed the woman who did set up Spinster for Feminist Current. So there's a podcast about it when she launched early on, and she's great.
Yes, yeah. And the other one, of course, is Posy Parker. Mm-hmm. She's really become a heroine, you know. And what I think is wonderful about her is that she seems to have influenced a new generation of young women. And they do seem to be mostly lesbians, I have to say, because this trans culture is about cancelling them as well.
Yep.
And they've been, it's wonderful to see. I mean, late last year and early this year, before the shutdowns, they were out and about in different cities in Britain with these putting banners on statues and hanging signs around the necks of statues, you know, the women with women pronoun, adult human female. And that's her influence. And I just thought that was absolutely great. That was really heartwarming to see, you know, young women actually getting out there and doing some real activism, you know, instead of just trying to hide behind the keyboard. You know, they were actually out there doing the sort of stuff that women used to do in my day, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that's great about Posy is that she says what she thinks regardless of the repercussions. You know, she speaks out. If she thinks it's important, she says something, and I think that more of us need to do that.
Yeah, and it isn't just important, Megan. It's essential, isn't it? Mm-hmm. We can't have half the human race, all the gay people, erased from history, can we?
Nope.
You know?
We definitely cannot. You're exactly right. And you're right that this is what this ideology, this gender identity ideology does, is it erases lesbians. It also erases women entirely. But without women, you can't have a lesbian.
Obviously, everybody else is talking about this, so we don't need to. But, I'm so grateful to talk to you. And, you know, the work you're doing and Posy's doing and other people that are out there is fantastic. I think, yeah, especially Scotland, look what's happening in Scotland as well. I think, you know, the tide could be turning, you know, on this sort of madness.
Yeah, the work they're doing in Scotland is really impressive.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, well, hopefully one day when we're allowed to travel again, we'll be able to meet in person. I'd love to meet you someday. I used to travel a bunch for work, or I have over the past year in any case, but that's stalled for a bit.
So. Well, that would be great. I'd love to meet up with Posy as well. So
yeah.
That's fantastic. Yeah, look forward to that, Megan.
Okay, so thank you so much again.
I hope it won't be the last time I speak to you. Okay.
I hope so. Bye-bye. Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You just heard an interview with Stella Perrette. You can learn more about her work at spanglefish.com/Stella Illustrator and follow her on Spinster at Artist Bristol. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. You can find us online at feministcurrent.com, tweet at us at feministcurrent, or send us an email at info@feministcurrent.com. We are hosted by Libsyn, and you can subscribe to the Feminist Current podcast anywhere you like to listen. iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, TuneIn, Spotify, and beyond. You can even give us 5 stars and a review on iTunes. Feminist Current is produced and hosted by myself, Megan Murphy, out of Vancouver, BC. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider making a donation to support our work. We rely on listeners and readers entirely to sustain us, and we are so grateful to those of you who do. Just visit feministcurrent.com and click the donate button.